You're tuned to KBOO Community Radio 90.7. Coming up, Art Focus is off today. Instead, we'll hear an excerpt from Background Briefing, featuring interviews with Naomi Oreskes, author of The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future, and paleontologist Peter Ward, a world expert on mass extinctions. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland 5, presenting an evening with Brazilian classical guitar duo, the Assad Brothers, with Romero Lubombo, Wednesday, June 24th at the Winningstad Theater. Tickets and information for the Assad Brothers is available at portland5.com.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Tucci Ristorante, an Italian dining house honoring the memory of Mary Cipolla Matucci and the spirit of the Lido restaurant in which she worked for 50 years. Tucci Ristorante features sustainable Northwest ingredients, drinks in the Lido bar, and is open every day in downtown Lake Oswego. Information at tucci.biz. That's TUCCI.BIZ.
I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Naomi Oreskes, who's a professor of the history of science and director of graduate studies at Harvard University. She received the Young Investigator Award from the National Science Foundation, served as a consultant to the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and was a consultant to the United States Nuclear Waste Technical Review Board. She is the co-author with Eric Conway of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming, and their latest book is The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. Welcome to Background Briefing, Naomi Oreskes.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
And understand that your work helped inform Pope Francis in the preparation of his encyclical on the environment. And your new book, which is grounded in science, portrays our planet in the not-too-distant future as the pile of filth the Pope has warned against.
Yeah, I know, the pile of filth, that was some pretty strong language. But yes, I was part of a meeting last year at the Vatican, a group of scientists from around the globe who met with leaders of the Vatican to try to lay down a kind of framework for what we think the scientific evidence tells us about the threats that uncontrolled environmental pollution and climate change represent, not just in a physical and scientific way, but also in human and social and cultural terms.
Of course, the Pope is I think, more than anything else, motivated by the effect of climate change on the poor, which would be the third world. So I take it you use the title, The Collapse of Western Civilization, as ironically, right?
Yeah, of course. And when we were writing the book, in a way, we were trying to do something similar to what the Pope has done, which is sort of exciting for us. We wanted to really explain why climate change matters, why it matters to people. So the Pope's encyclicals particularly focused on issues of social justice. We were more focused in our book on the question of governance and what climate change means for the survival of Western liberal forms of democracy. Because when we were writing the book Merchants of Doubt, one of the things we learned was that the people who deny climate change often see themselves as defending democracy. They're afraid that climate change will be used as an excuse to justify a big government control, big government takeover of the economy. But what we tried to point out was that by denying climate change, they actually make that more likely because they increase the likelihood of very disruptive social unrest, food shortages, food riots, the kinds of unrest that in fact lead to government takeovers of the marketplace and that lead to the suppression of civil liberties. So if you really care about freedom and democracy, as well as caring about the poor social justice, you really ought to be very, very concerned about uncontrolled climate change.
Well, the intelligence services are. I've spoken to a number of people who have attended international conferences of the various Western intelligence agencies. And for the longest time, climate change has been on the top of the agenda.
Well, that's right. And, you know, in Merchants of Doubt, we talked about that, how the national security organizations, the CIA, the military, have long recognized that climate change represents a national security threat. And the very fact that they do recognize that, and yet we still have climate deniers in Congress in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere, pretending that this problem isn't even real, in a way, it shows us how extreme these people have become and how unprincipled their position is, because it's not simply a matter of saying, well, look, we agree on the problem, but we don't agree on the right solution. These people are just in complete and total denial. And again, in the new book, one of the things we try to bring out is, who they really represent. And so we coined this phrase that's gaining a bit of currency, the carbon combustion complex, trying to point out that just as once upon a time we were sort of the prisoners of the military-industrial complex, increasingly we're really prisoners of a carbon combustion complex of people who are doing everything possible, going to any length to defend the right of people to burn cheap fossil fuels, no matter what the cost.
Again, I'm speaking with Naomi Oreskes, who's a professor of history, the history of science, and director of the graduate studies at Harvard University. She received the Young Investigator Award from the National Science Foundation, served as a consultant to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and was a consultant to the United States Nuclear Waste Technical Review Board. She's the co-author with Eric Conway of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. And the latest book is The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. So there are, of course, we mentioned how the intelligence in terms of the intelligence world and the national security world, they get it in terms of global warming being a clear and present danger. And in contrast, we have the head of the Senate Science Panel and the head of the House Science Panel, both climate change deniers. And your book, basically, the narrator of your new book, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future, concludes that in the 21st century, the forces of climate change denial prevailed. So that's the James Imhoff wins the argument, but we all lose the planet, right?
Right. Well, that's the whole premise of the book, is what does this look like if climate change denial prevails? And the answer is it doesn't really look good for the defenders of Western civilization or the defenders of Western-style liberal democracy, that if we don't take action, and so, the story sort of plays out, what does that look like? So we see food riots, unrest, massive sea level rise leads to dislocation of people. And in the story, it's the totalitarian, authoritarian governments like in China that really are more able to cope with the disruption than liberal democracies. And so in the future, a historian in the year 2393 in the Second People's Republic of China looks back on us and says, well, why did this happen? These people knew so much about what was going on. They had so much sophisticated science. They had extremely advanced technology, and yet they allowed this disaster to unfold before their eyes. And so the book is a way of kind of shedding light on what's going on today by looking at it from the perspective of the future.
So in the book, though, what percentage of the Earth is lost to ocean level rise?
That's a good question. I'm not sure if we actually give a percentage, but one of the ways we wrote the book was to take all the scientific evidence and sort of play out a worst-case scenario. So if we took, actual scientific work and said, well, what if the high end of these estimates is correct? What does that look like? And so I think ultimately we took an estimate of 11 meters of sea level rise. And actually at the time, it's now 2 years since we wrote this book, I thought maybe we were pushing the envelope a little bit, going that high in terms of sea level rise. But just this week, I was talking to a scientist in the United Kingdom who's been studying the Eocene period of geological history a few million years ago. And in the Eocene, carbon dioxide was at 400 parts per million. So that's the same as it is today. And sea level was 11 meters higher than it is today. Now, of course, we won't go to 11 meters of sea level rise overnight. It will take quite a lot of time, probably centuries, for that to unfold. But this is really, really frightening. It means that we are already today at a level of carbon dioxide that if we don't do something essentially immediately, we are looking at a long-term future that really does involve catastrophic sea level rise that would dislocate at least tens, if not hundreds of millions of people around the globe. So this is really not a joke anymore. And it's kind of staggering to me that there are people in Washington, D.C. who can look a camera in the eye and say with a straight face, that they think climate change is a hoax, or they don't know what's really happened, they don't know what's causing it. I mean, to say that in light of the amount of scientific evidence that we now have, it's really unconscionable. And I do think that people in the future will look back on these people, and they will not be kind. Future historians, our own grandchildren, will not look kindly on the people who prevented action on climate change.
Well, but in a way, you know, you get the government you deserve, and if we have idiots in our government, you know, it's our fault. I mean, look at the government of Australia. I mean, the guy is a complete idiot. He's an embarrassment. The Australian people they have buyer's remorse, but the reason he got in was that the Labor Party fought amongst itself to the point where people got fed up, and they voted this clown in. And you know, but he's in there to stay for a while. He'll do enormous damage. You know, I you know, it's one thing to as I just call them idiots, which I think is a fair term. But it's another thing to, you know, for the our side of the argument, if for the want of a better description, get sufficiently motivated to win power back, particularly if so much power is abdicated by passivity and you know, inertia.
Well, that's certainly true, and I do feel like one of the lessons of history is a reminder that it's really important to stay focused on the big picture and not to let small differences of opinion cause people to lose sight of the shared and common goals. And I've really felt that this week because, you know, there have been some people who have been sort of quibbling with certain aspects of the Pope's encyclical. And, of course, I don't think that any progressive or liberal or feminist would have expected to agree with everything that the Pope said. And certainly, I think, you know, many of us might have a slightly different view about birth control than the Pope, let's say. But nevertheless, there's so much that's good and important and correct in the Pope's encyclical, including, in my opinion, his point that we should be focusing on consumption rather than population, which I think is exactly right. I think a lot of people in the United States and elsewhere get that issue wrong. So, you know, the really important thing is to say we are pretty clear here about what needs to happen. We're not all going to agree on all the details. But we do have to sort of, in a way, be compassionate and tolerant to each other and work together. At the same time, I also feel like, you know, when you say we get the government we deserve, I don't really feel that way because I feel like one of the whole points of the book Merchants of Doubt and now the film that we've made with Robbie Kenner is to say, look, we've been the victims of a gigantic fraud. And the victims of fraud are victims. They're not the criminals. The criminals are the people who perpetrate the fraud. So, yes, you could argue we should all be smarter. We should pay more attention. And certainly, Eric Conway and I feel like now that we've written this book and we've made this wonderful film with Robbie Kenner, anybody who gets fooled by this now, you know, there's not so much an excuse. Like, our eyes have been opened and we need to now not be fooled again. But I do think that we shouldn't be beating up on ourselves for what the Merchants of Doubt has done. I mean, the moral responsibility for that lies with them.
My understanding is you as a scientist privately are getting even worse indications of how things are much worse than you even put in the book. I don't know whether you saw the Vice TV series on HBO. They did a piece where they went on the NASA jet that maps the ice depth of ice over Antarctica. And it was just alarming. The people that are doing the actual research says, this is so much worse than we think. This is just outrageous what's happening. So is that the signal that you're getting, that maybe even in your scenario, you downplay the danger?
No, not worse than we put in the class of Western civilization. But the whole reason we wrote the book the way it was because we did think that what was unfolding, what was happening, was in fact worse than what was being written in the IPCC reports and the other scientific reports. So we had evidence, and I actually wrote a peer-reviewed paper on this with some colleagues. We had some pretty clear evidence that the mainstream scientific reports coming out of the IPCC and the U.S. National Research Council and being published in the peer-reviewed literature, that these formal scientific reports were underestimating the threat, and that they were well, we called it erring on the side of least drama. They were kind of underplaying the threat, trying to stay calm, trying not to sound alarmist, trying not to sound emotional, hysterical, and that actually those formal reports were erring on the side of the underestimate rather than either being overestimated or correct. And so when Eric and I were writing The Collapse of Western Civilization, we took that to heart and we said, well, what if that's true generally? What if in general these scientific estimates are tending to be on the low side? And what if the truth is actually on the high side? And so that was the justification for writing a narrative based on pulling out the implications, not of making things up. Everything in the book, well, with one or two possible exceptions, virtually everything in the book is based on scientific evidence published in peer-reviewed literatures, but taking the high end of the estimate. So, you know, if scientists are saying that doubling warming would lead to 1.5 degrees C, we say, well, what if that upper end, what if that 4.5 is the right answer and not the 1.5? And I think certainly we see evidence that the correct answer is, well, it's probably closer to 3 than it is to 2. And of course, nobody's expecting CO2 to stop at doubling. We have, you know, if we continue where we're on now, we can expect carbon dioxide to go way past 550 parts per million. And now lots and lots of people in the scientific community are talking about climate change of at least 4 degrees. So, again, we didn't have to make anything up. We were able to kind of construct a narrative just based on the scientific evidence, assuming that the past estimates have been a little bit too cautious, too conservative, and that the truth is actually really quite worrisome.
Well, Naomi Oreskes, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much. It's always a pleasure speaking with you.
Naomi Oreskes is a professor of the history of science and director of graduate studies at Harvard University. She received the Young Investigator Award from the National Science Foundation, served as a consultant to the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and was a consultant to the U.S. Nuclear Waste Technical Review Board. She is the co-author with Eric Conway of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. And their latest book is The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Peter Ward, who's a paleontologist who teaches biology and earth and space sciences at the University of Washington. He has published widely on biodiversity and the fossil fuel record and is an expert on mass extinctions. And his award-winning books include Under a Green Sky, which pointed out that all but one of the major extinction events in history have been brought on by climate change, the same global warming that occurs today. He's the author of The Flooded Earth, How Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps, and his latest book is A New History of Life, The Radical New Discoveries About the Origins and Evolution of Life on Earth. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Ward.
It's so good of you to have me, and thank you.
There's a report that was released on Friday in the journal Science Advances by scientists from Stanford, Princeton, and Berkeley, saying that we're in the sixth mass extinction phase, that the Earth is now entering it. And, of course, the fifth mass extinction was 65 million years ago that wiped out the dinosaurs. Since you're an expert on mass extinctions, where do you put us? I mean, obviously, we're talking on a long time scale here.
Well, we are, but unfortunately, the time scale isn't long enough, Ian. We really are seeing that there are at least 10 extinctions as big as the ones posited. The trouble with the mass extinction work that's being done now, it's like presumed that animals prior to those with a backbone don't really count for mass extinction. If we go back to the time before we have animals at all, we had major catastrophes. I understand and I see that we are losing vertebrates, and the bulk of the study you're looking at is looking just at that. It's how fast are vertebrates, our kind, going extinct? But again, I think this is a very short-sighted look. If you really want to see when and how the current pulse of extinction is taking place, you should look when it started. Let's go and look at the biggest of all the creatures that should be counted in this mass extinction, the mammoths, the mastodons, and even those giant kangaroo-like forms in Australia, and that began 50,000 years ago. So most of the mammal extinction of this last even 20,000 years took place early on and had very little to do with humans. So we are looking at this pulse of extinction, all right, but on the other hand, if you really compare the metrics, the sort of sense of horrible scare that we are looking at something as big as anything in the past just is not correct. The Permian extinction, the end Cretaceous extinction, they're far more devastating and faster than what is being posited for today.
So how do you distinguish between environmental mass distinction, and for example, the extinction of the African elephants, which we know why they're taking place. They're taking place because largely because of poaching for ivory, and in the terms of the tiger, it's the Tibetan poachers that are killing it off. So it's definitely the man at his worst.
Yeah, it is, and I think a guy named Richard Baumbach, another paleontologist, had, I think, the best sort of new look at this. He said, don't call them mass extinctions, let's call them mass depletions. And clearly, we are seeing a depletion in so many different kinds of animals. Extinction is very difficult to do, and you have to get every one of those breeding pairs. And in fact, we're going to not have the extinction of tigers or elephants, because we'll keep them in zoos or somehow around. But nevertheless, what really is taking place is mass depletion on a scale that is truly horrific. We are seeing now that many stocks of animals and plants and invertebrates are being reduced in number, and human overpopulation and habitat change is clearly involved. It just gets very tricky, though, and it's so easy to fall into hyperbole when you start comparing what we're doing now to the past mass extinctions, all of which had very different causes than what ostensibly we humans are doing to the planet.
This new report should be even more damning, but the finger should be pointing at us, not some external environmental catastrophe.
Yeah, I think that we've got to be very careful. The environmental arena lets itself open to people like Lombard and the skeptical environmentalists. And just as we've seen where imprecise work in climate change opens the door for people who totally misrepresent and change, we just have to be so clearly conservative and not yelling, oh my gosh, you know, once again, we've got one of these major mass extinctions. We have something that's just different from anything that's happened in the past. You cannot compare it. You are seeing processes that we humans are doing that are unlike an asteroid coming down, and they're certainly unlike most of the mass extinctions, which are caused by really rapid temperature rise, really low oxygen, and killing hydrogen sulfide coming out of the oceans. That's not happening.
Well, just to be fair to the study, though, perhaps I may have mischaracterized it a little bit here. The researchers wrote that our analysis emphasizes that our global society has started to destroy species of other organisms at an accelerating rate, initiating a mass extinction episode unparalleled for 65 million years. Avoiding a true sixth mass extinction will require rapid, greatly intensified efforts to conserve already threatened species and to alleviate pressures on their populations, notably habitat loss, overexploitation for economic gain, and climate change. However, the window of opportunity is rapidly closing.
Well, there's certainly a lot to be alarmed with, but again, without being a stick in the mud here, if you go back to the Permian extinction, when 90% of all species disappeared, or the end Cretaceous that they talk about, which has now been thought to be at least 75% of species, we are not coming anywhere close to that. The species that have gone extinct are bird species on islands. They're mammal species on islands. It is these tiny habitats which become overrun with humans where most of those extinctions have taken place. This is not to say that we can't get up to the Permian extinction levels over the next centuries or millennia if we keep at it. But to say that we're there now, I think, is a misrepresentation.
Well, I think it doesn't say that we're there now, that we're entering our sixth mass extinction phase. So I guess that's not quite the same.
Well, yeah, I mean, the entering, maybe they're correct in the entering, but again, I just haven't even looked at these other mass extinctions when you see that things all the way down to the size of bacteria are going out. We are definitely taking out mammals, and we're taking out birds especially that are so narrowly adapted. But the great mass extinctions not only took out the narrowly adapted, they took out the generalists too. It was almost like the great David Raup pointed out, mass extinction is that bad genes or bad luck, really, because almost everything across the board goes out. I think it's an absolute service now to point out that we are seeing so many species going extinct that we can blame directly on habitat change and habitat loss. But a mass extinction takes out everything, really. You go all the way down to the protozoa in a pond. And again, we really do not even know how many species there are on the planet, whereas we have a much better handle of how many there were in the deep past. So, you know, I don't want to sound like a Pollyanna about this, but it's just figures have to be done so carefully. There has to be such a conservative view. But nevertheless, looking at what we're seeing today, it's scary.
Well, we were just speaking with Naomi Oreskes, who's written about global warming deniers and has written on the collapse of Western civilization, a view from the future, which sort of posits what the world would be look like if the efforts to deal with climate change are not sabotaged as they have been for some time by the deniers. And if the deniers win the argument, if the chairman of the Senate and House science committees have their way, they portray a world with 11 meters rise in sea level. Surely that would create, well, it may not be mass extinctions, but my God, there's going to be a lot of extinction, wouldn't there be, with that kind of sea level rise?
Yeah, and I think the sea level rise isn't going to kill the species. What's going to happen, the sea level rise is going to push human civilization into new areas, and we will have to increase our farmlands. In my book, The Flooded Earth, it's just sea level rise was the most dangerous aspect of climate change to me, simply because so much of human agriculture takes place at very low elevation. The rice fields of Asia, you don't need 11 meters of sea level change to totally perturb that. Bangladesh, for heaven's sake, 11 meters is going to cover the vast majority of that country. 1 meter of sea level rise is going to put huge pressure on Bangladesh to be able to feed itself, which it currently can. And so there it becomes the indirect effect. Now some forests that are still left and are not taken down will have to be, because we will need to increase the farmland. So here's where the nasty sort of aspect of it comes around.
Do you think, in terms of the Pope's encyclical that we were talking about earlier, are you feeling a little encouraged? You wrote the book, The Flooded Earth, clearly, and I remember we talked about some of the solutions that you thought were attainable that could make a difference, like if everybody on the planet painted their roofs white and the roads were white and parking lots were white, a lot of sun would get reflected. That doesn't seem like a terrible hardship on us humans. The Pope has, I think, come out pretty strongly, hasn't he?
Oh, the Pope's been amazing. Yes, indeed. And I think, you know, if we look at what has happened in the public consciousness in the last 10 years, and I kind of like to put it at the whole conversation about marriage between same-sex people, even 10 years ago, that was so verboten in the United States, and that's so quickly changed. It's akin to, I think everyone now understands that climate change is real and that it is a force that is taking place. And I think even 10 years ago, maybe only 10% of the populace would have been worried or haven't even heard about it. So yeah, it's like a 12-step program. We have acknowledged that there is a problem, at least most of us, but the set of solutions keeps running up against the rapid population growth. And I heard your last speaker so eloquent that this heading up to 9 billion people is going to put more and more and more pressure on the habitats to the left.
And if the sea level rises only a few meters, that will even make greater pressure on the remaining habitats, which will be tried to turn them into some kind of agricultural land.
Well, that's exactly it. Yeah. Some of the new figures that come out, for instance, I just heard that Nigeria is expected to have a population of 400 to 500 million people by the end of the century, a half billion people in Nigeria alone. And the surface area of Nigeria is about the size, I think it's less than Washington State and Oregon, a piece of Oregon. You're not talking about a very large piece of real estate.
Right.
And then you're going to have a half billion people. So there's a place where you had forests and you had a great number of species. I think where we can finally get to, yes, indeed, there is this major mass extinction. If we lose two things on the planet irrevocably, the coral reefs and the rainforests are the two great arcs of diversity. If they are indeed destroyed, if
right.
we lose the coral reefs, then we've got problems.
Well, we have to end it there, but I thank you very much for joining us, Sir Peter Ward.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Ward. He's a paleontologist who teaches biology and Earth and space sciences at the University of Washington. He's published widely on biodiversity and fossil fuel records and is an expert on mass extinction. And among his award-winning books is Under a Green Sky, which pointed out that all but one of the major extinction events in history have been brought on by climate change.